morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Tate. Counsel for appellant.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Brian Miser, and I represent the appellant, hospital corpsman, second class, David Tate. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
There are three important statutory rights that arise after every court-martial. The right to submit clemency to the convening authority, the right to appeal to the Service Court of Appeals and to this court, and the right to seek clemency and parole from the Secretary of the Navy. In its 55-year history, this court has never held that any of these rights is properly the subject of waiver provision as part of a pretrial agreement, and it should not do so today. The President, in 1984, implicitly recognizing the importance of these rights, precluded the waiver of any post-trial rights as part of a pretrial agreement by promulgating RCM 705C1B. Now, this court is well acquainted with the legislative history surrounding and congressional intent surrounding the creation of the service courts and of this court. But the framers of the Uniform Code were equally, and of the Elson Act a year earlier, were also determined that there be a clemency power separate and distinct and independent from that also given to the convening authority by the Elson Act and the Code. And nowhere is that more evident than in an exchange between General Eisenhower and Congressman Elston on July 15, 1947, at pages 4424 and 4425 of the House hearings. General Eisenhower and Secretary of War Patterson went to the Congress that day to argue about a clemency provision that had been proposed in the Elson Act. And General Eisenhower specifically wanted clemency power to be vested in, quote, with some responsibility for winning the war. So the war fighters were supposed to have this clemency power. And General Eisenhower discussed how clemency had worked in World War II as he talks about the Second Ardennes Offensive in the winter of 1944. And he says, quote, as quickly as those sentences were all given, after the files were concluded, I went into that group of men with my judge advocate and with General Lear, and I offered every one of them this, complete opportunity to exonerate himself if he would volunteer for the front line. Congressman Elston replied to General Eisenhower that the convening authority already has the ability to refer charges to court. He has control over the pretrial investigation and the prosecutorial discretion. He has the ability to appoint the trial defense counsel, the trial counsel, and also the law officer. And he has the authority to approve or disapprove in whole or in part the sentence. And then he replies, quote, now what more authority can a commanding officer ask for, end quote. And the government's answer today, 60 years later, is that the government and the convening authority should also have control over the Secretary's clemency power. That is specifically what Congress, in enacting Article of War 51 and later UCMJ Article 74, intended to deny the convening authority. Although the legislative history of Article 74 is much shorter than that of Article 51, it makes clear that it was enacted, as the House hearings indicate, to correct, quote, grievous mistakes in the severity of sentence. That is something that should not be returned to the convening authority. Thus, in this case, there is an affirmative indication of Congress's intent to preclude waiver, as the Supreme Court discussed in United States versus Mezzanotto. And you will recall that in Mezzanotto, some evidentiary provisions are so fundamental to the reliability of a trial that they cannot be waived. The clemency power that is resides in Article 74 and then later in 10 U.S.C. 952 and 953 are so fundamental to the reliability of military justice that they also cannot be waived. This case is very similar to the case of United States versus Mills, where this court rejected an agreement that waived appellate review because of the congressional solicitude for full appellate review of courts martial.
Can I just clarify, are you making two arguments then? Are you, first of all, you're relying on the plain text of the rule and arguing that this form of clemency, right to petition for clemency, is a post-trial right, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Are you subtly dealing with the analysis and now saying it's also a fundamental right?
Well, Your Honor,
what's the fundamental right? And need it be a fundamental right to be a complete and effective exercise of a post-trial right?
It does not need to be a fundamental right, Your Honor. But as I previously stated, there are three important statutory rights. It is one of those three important statutory rights that Congress intended when it created the Elson Act and also the UCMJ.
Okay. It's not up to me to tell you whether your argument is it's a fundamental right or not. Is it a fundamental right? Are you making that separate assertion?
It is a fundamental right, along with the right to appeal to this court. There are two pillars that Congress intended to establish to check the awesome power that it had given the convening authority, the ability, the rights that I previously enumerated. Those two pillars are the right to appeal to the service court, to this court, and then independent of that, even if the service court got it wrong and this court got it wrong because this court is confined to questions of law, the service secretary had the ability to equalize the sentence and grant clemency.
So are you arguing it's a fundamental right because that's what's in the analysis, or are you arguing it's a fundamental right because there's some Supreme Court case or something that says it's a fundamental right? Or are you arguing descriptively that it's a fundamental right based on the Elson Act?
Your Honor, the legislative history indicates that it's a fundamental right. It was a right that Congress intended not be waived. It was fundamental.
Fundamental in a military justice context, or fundamental in how the Supreme Court looks at fundamental rights?
In the UCMJ context, Your Honor. And in that respect, it's very similar to United States versus Mills, where this court rejected a pretrial agreement that waived appellate review because of the congressional solicitude for full appellate review of courts martial. Congress had a similar desire to create an independent clemency power that resided with the secretaries, and this pretrial agreement interferes with that. In fact, the Congress has been so determined to provide this right that they did it in Article 51, they did it in Article 74, and then in 1968, they do it again in the Military Correctional Facilities Act with 10 U.S.C. 952 and 953. So these statutes reflect that determination on the part of Congress that this clemency power, parole power, be independent of the convening authority, and it is fundamental with respect to military justice, how our system functions, and the delicate balance that Congress has struck between the need for good order and discipline, good order and discipline, and at the same time sentences and procedures that are fundamentally fair, and this is instrumental in that balance. It is that concern which prohibits waiver of appellate review as part of a pretrial agreement, even though, as this court noted last term in United States versus Miller, that Congress has provided a narrow window through Article 61A to waive appellate review independent of an appellate agreement. If you contrast that with the federal system, the circuit court across the street and many of the federal circuit courts of appeal will allow accused to waive appellate review, and in many cases will even allow defendants to waive collateral attack on their convictions. It is the intent of Congress that sets this case aside from similar cases in the civilian court system. It is the intent of Congress that there be this independent court system in the service courts of criminal appeals with this court, and then also with this clemency power as a last resort for military service members. Similarly, the fact that Secretary of the Navy Instruction 5815-3J also provides for a waiver provision does not mean that it may be incorporated into pretrial agreements, given the congressional intent behind the creation of clemency and parole. Justice Owen J. Roberts, who upon retiring from the Supreme Court, was appointed by the Secretary of the War to head the War Department's Advisory Board on Clemency. He referred to clemency as, quote, the capstone of the whole system of military justice, end quote. And if the right to seek clemency from the convening authority is a service member's last best hope for relief, the right to seek clemency from the Secretary of the Navy is, in fact, a service member's last hope for relief. And it was a hope that Congress intended remain independent of the convening authority. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Counsel, are we talking here only about clemency under Article 74?
No, Your Honor. Article 74 also contemplates parole. And if you read the the Senate report that was cited in the 36A letter, it indicates that Article 74 contemplates a right for clemency and parole pursuant to Article 74.
Well, that's my question. Is there any clemency that this appellant waived outside of Article 74?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. The clemency that he's arguing for is that established by the Secretary of the Navy through Article 74, and then reaffirmed, if you will, in 10 U.S.C. 952 and 953, clemency and parole under the Military Correctional Facilities Act of 1968.
Counsel, if we were to agree with your argument and say that this provision should be invalidated, the remedy that you request is that it just be invalidated and that your client not be bound by it. But isn't there an argument that this is a material provision in the pretrial agreement and that once it's invalidated on appeal, taking that out of the mix, the government might not have made the agreement that they made, and why shouldn't it be sent back?
Certainly, Your Honor, there is an argument, and in fact, one of the cases that I cited out of New York State says that these agreements are void ab initio, and so therefore the agreement should be invalidated. But the plain language of RCM 705 says that this type of term just will not be enforced, which clearly implies that the remainder of the agreement would remain intact. And in fact, the two dissenting members of the Gansimer decision, Judge Wiss and Judge Sullivan, suggest that the invalid provision, or what they believe to be an invalid provision in that case, should also be struck from that case. So I think RCM 705 serves as guidance for this court as to what the appropriate remedy is, which is to give my client the right that Congress intended, the right to clemency, the right to petition for clemency, the right to petition for parole, and leave the remainder of the agreement intact.
Even though that was part of a quid pro quo that got him a pretty favorable sentence limitation.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. It's the plain language of RCM 705. It says that this provision will not be enforced. And so, if the government wishes to engage in contracts or negotiations that are specifically barred by the black letter of the RCM, then that is the risk the government undertakes also in doing so.
If the appellant brings this issue before us, does the appellant run the risk of having the entire plea agreement validated and starting at the beginning of the case again?
He certainly does, Your Honor, and that is a risk that he is willing to accept.
Okay, and RCM 705 does not literally preclude this court from invalidating the plea agreement in its entirety.
It does not, Your Honor. It just says that these terms will not be enforced, which certainly implies that the remainder of the agreement would be enforced. It certainly implies that you could invalidate a certain provision of a pretrial agreement without.
If we were to invalidate the agreement as a whole, would we not be ensuring that RCM 705 is followed? That is, under those circumstances, that provision would not be enforced.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Now, if we invalidate the entire agreement following Judge Erdman's question about whether this was a material provision, there's nothing in invalidating that agreement that would fail to follow the mandate of RCM 705 that this particular provision not be enforced. Because if you invalidate the whole agreement, then this provision could not be enforced as well as the rest of the agreement.
Certainly, Your Honor, that is one interpretation. It's not the interpretation that appellant would urge this court to adopt.
I understand.
But in the alternative, should this court, in response to Judge Erdman's question, find that this is a material provision and the entire agreement should be invalidated, we would ask this court to pose the same question to the government, whether or not they determine this to be a material provision, and take the government's position on whether or not the entire agreement should be thrown out here today. But as I said, appellant is aware of that possibility and is prepared to accept that risk to avail himself of these important statutory rights. It shouldn't be necessary because of the language that is in 705, but arguing the alternative. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you.
Your Honor, it's Major Brian Keller. I represent the government. This is a case about buyer's remorse. Appellant struck a deal with the government, and after having received a substantial benefit from that pretrial agreement, limiting his adjudged life without possibility of parole to a sentence of 50 years with the possibility of parole after 20 years, appellant now contends that his agreement, or that provision of his agreement, is void because of RCM 705C and by public policy, and also now because he says that it's a fundamental right. The RCM chapters 11 and 12 do not include clemency and parole as defined within the Secretary of the Navy instruction. An appellant conflates the right to request clemency and parole with the duty to conduct a clemency and parole review that the Secretary of the Navy has per the statutory provisions appellant cited. RCM 705C1B says, quote, a term or condition will not be enforced if it deprives the right to complete and effective exercise of post-trial and appellate rights. Appellant hangs his hat on this provision, or he has. However, RCM permits appellant's waiver. Clemency and parole is undefined in RCM 103, the definition section. The RCM nowhere brings the Secretary of the Navy instruction 58, 15.3J into the ambit of the RCM, nor vice versa.
That raises then the question I asked defense appellate counsel, and that is, are we dealing with the Secretary's powers under Article 74, or are we dealing with some independent power here that's being waived?
Yes, Your Honor, we're dealing with the Secretary of the Navy instruction, which explicitly sets out, per the requirement of the USC, the clemency and parole system. The Secretary of the Navy has detailed the clemency and parole system and created rights in the Secretary of the Navy instruction itself to clemency and parole, or rather, the right to petition for clemency and parole. It also, in the Secretary of the Navy instruction, creates the right to waive clemency review, sections 132 and 410. It explicitly creates those rights. And in section 505, it permits appellant not to request, which affects then a waiver of the parole system as well, Your Honor.
So is it the government's position that the appellant in this case waived his rights under Secretary of Navy instruction but did not waive his rights under Article 74?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the pretrial agreement itself states that he is waiving his rights under the Secretary of the Navy instruction, Your Honor.
But the second, I asked a compound question, so let me make sure that I'm clear on your answer. Does that mean that he's not waiving his rights under Article 74?
Yes, sir. It means he's only waiving his rights under the Secretary of the Navy instruction. The right to petition for clemency is explicitly created within the Secretary of the Navy instruction.
Is that Secretary of Navy instruction independent of Article 74?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, because the Secretary of the Navy himself or herself must set up a system of clemency and review, or clemency and parole, which he has done. So there's a system of clemency and parole which the appellant may appeal himself to. He's got the right to petition, but the Secretary of the Navy also must conduct clemency and parole reviews, and he may do so discretionarily even if appellant doesn't waives his right to request clemency and parole, which in this case he has. He's waived that right to request that.
So under the agreement, as it's drafted, in light of that answer, the appellant today could submit a request to the Secretary of the Navy to remit or suspend any or all part of the unexecuted part of the sentence, including the confinement now not served. And what I'm trying to figure out is, how's the Secretary going to do that? Is he going to create a new, a separate parallel system of parole under Article 74 that's parallel to the instruction?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Are you talking about Article 74?
Right.
Yes, sir. It states that the undersecretary, the secretary concerned, the judge advocate general, commanding officer may remit or suspend any part or amount of the unexecuted part of the sentence. I believe that's what you're quoting, Your Honor.
Right. So there's a large part of his confinement that remains unexecuted right now.
Yes, sir.
And so if he hasn't waived his right to submit under Article 74, then he can still make a submission saying, I would like to have the remainder of my sentence or a certain part either suspended or remitted. I'm going to go on parole. And he can do that today without any restriction.
Your Honor, Article 74 says nothing about the appellant's right to submit clemency matters or parole matters. The right to petition is in the Secretary of the Navy instruction itself. Article 74 clearly says, the plain language says, that the officials may remit or suspend the sentence.
Oh, and so that, are you changing your answer then? Are you saying that he's also waived his right to make any submission under Article 74?
No, Your Honor, I see nothing in Article 74 that says an appellant may submit matters to authorities to submit, to remit the sentence, to grant clemency, to grant parole. That's within the Secretary of the Navy instruction. Those rights are created within the Secretary of the Navy instruction, Your Honor, like the right to an admin board.
So,
go ahead.
So what's the SECNAV instruction mean when it says that this regulation implements the clemency and parole systems authorized in Article 74 and 10 U.S.C. 952, et cetera?
It does indeed, Your Honor.
So how do we know whether the right to petition, is that, you're saying that's not based on Article 74?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the regulation's based on Article 74, but you happen to know that that particular right is not?
Your Honor, the Secretary of Navy instruction, yes, Your Honor, the Secretary of the Navy instruction explicitly creates the right to petition. By analogy, one of the cases that's integral, I believe, to this Court's decision in this case, the Gansmer case in 1993, held that an appellant may waive his right to a post-trial administrative board. Now, the RCM itself discusses, and I believe it's Section 1206, I could be wrong about that, discusses administrative separations. It says that the Secretary may supplant an administrative separation for a court-martial conviction. Now, the right isn't created to petition for administrative board in that section of the RCM. The right is created in another in another instruction. And as in this case, Your Honor, Article 74 says that a clemency and parole system, the right to, remission of sentences may be conducted by officials. However, the right to submit to request clemency and parole itself is created within the Secretary of the Navy instruction.
I'm not clear that the Gansler case stands for the proposition that rights, post-trial rights under the UCMJ can be waived. That provision of the UCMJ, which says that the Secretary can substitute a administrative discharge for a punitive discharge, is wholly separate, as I understand it, from the administrative discharge system. That is, if an accused, as part of a pretrial agreement, waives the right to have an administrative board, that's a board under a set of laws and rules that are wholly apart from the Uniform Code of Military Justice. As the Supreme Court held in Clinton against Goldsmith, we have no jurisdiction over those matters. But when the Secretary substitutes an administrative discharge for a punitive discharge, that's not being done by a board. He's taking that BCD or the DD and saying, I'm going to change it here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Waiving, that's the waiver in Gansler had nothing to do with that particular provision.
No, that's correct.
That was a waiver of a non-UCMJ provision.
Yes, Your Honor.
So here my question is, this is a UCMJ provision. The UCMJ in Article 74 says these are the powers of the Secretary. Those are powers that are exercised after trial. Why aren't the powers in Article 74 post-trial rights that are governed by the provision on pretrial agreements that say you can't waive a post-trial right? Here it is right in the UCMJ. You've got a right to have the Secretary consider you for these matters under Article 74.
Yes, Your Honor, and that right has not been waived in this pretrial agreement.
So now he only has the right to have the Secretary consider it if the Secretary, on his or her own motion, comes up with the idea.
Yes, sir, and that right is duplicated within the Secretary of the Navy instruction. The lower court in both Tate and Thomas found, according to the proposition you just made, which was that an appellant may not waive the right to be considered or offered clemency or parole. And that's exactly, the government contends, the situation you suggested, Your Honor. Appellant may not waive that right. If he is considered sua sponte by the Secretary of the Navy, or in some cases the Navy Clemency or Parole Board, then there are specific sections within the Secretary of the Navy instruction to do so. He may not waive the right to be offered that. That's a right that is a duty of the Secretary of the Navy and the Navy and Clemency and Parole Board to conduct that review. And that is consistent with Article 74, Your Honor. However...
But he can waive the right. Can he waive the right to request clemency from the convening authority?
Your Honor, under 1105, a 1105 is a right that's inside the rules for court martial, so that is something that has nothing to do with the Secretary of the Navy instruction. And the Secretary of the Navy instruction itself explicitly excludes 1105 matters within the ambit of the Secretary of the Navy instruction. So that has nothing, yes, Your Honor, he cannot waive that under, that's not what is being talked about.
I understand that, but if the government's argument is that a waiver can be constructed of Article 74, why can't a waiver be constructed as to the other post-trial rights that an individual has?
Your Honor, the reason is that the RCM, it's in the RCM. The reason is that it's in the RCM. Clemency, as it's talked about within the section, clemency itself is talked about only 5 times in the rules for court martial. It's talked about only 4 times in Chapters 11 and 12, which are the post-trial and appellate rights. Parole is talked about, is mentioned 6 times in the rules for court martial, and only 2 times in Chapters 11 and 12, which were post-trial and appellate rights. The list of matters which may not be waived in RCM 705C are several due process rights plus 2 specific things. One is a complete sentencing hearing, which was addressed by this court in the Edwards case, and the second is post-trial and appellate rights, which falls within the ambit of the Gansmer case, which was the Court of Military Appeals in 1993. In the Edwards case, this court held that a complete sentencing proceeding, notice the word complete, does not mean exhaustive without exception. There, the appellant waived the right to bring up in mitigation and extenuation the fact that he had been interrogated without counsel present by Air Force Office of Special Investigations agents. The court said that that was fine, that can be waived. So therefore, complete doesn't mean complete in all senses.
Well, counsel, if clemency and parole under the Secretary of the Navy instruction is not a post-trial right,
yes, Your Honor.
What would you term it? What is it?
Your Honor, it's a post-trial right, but it's not a post-trial right within the sense of the rules for court-martial. There's no contradiction there, Your Honor. The rules for court-martial specifically talk about several due process rights which may not be waived, and then they talk about complete sentencing proceeding, which obviously has exceptions. Complete doesn't mean complete, and it talks about post-trial and appellate rights.
But on the face of it, it would appear to say you can't waive post-trial rights. You just said that it is a post-trial right, but it's not a post-trial right for purposes of the RCM.
Your Honor, yes, Your Honor, that's a semantic trap, though, because the RCM itself has, it lists specific rights which, the RCM itself creates specific post-trial and appellate rights. Those rights in the RCM, the government would argue...
So your argument is that it's limited to post-trial rights that are created in the RCM?
Yes, Your Honor, Chapters 11 and 12. The language in the RCM section here, 705C, talks about... the complete and effective exercise of post-trial and appellate rights. Chapter 11 is post-trial processing. Chapter 12 is appellate processing.
Okay, other than the fact that there are provisions in the RCM that deal with post-trial rights, is there anything else? I mean, what else do you rely upon to limit post-trial rights in 705 to only those created by the RCM?
Well, Your Honor, the fact that the Secretary of the Navy instruction excludes 1105, it excludes sections of the RCM itself specifically, the fact that the RCM does not mention parole as a right, it simply mentions the sentence of parole, life without the possibility of parole. So it's an entity, the Navy clemency parole system, the parole and clemency system is an entity outside of the RCM here, Your Honor. It's not referred to in the RCM, it's not meant to be within the ambit of the RCM. Those rights which may be waivable would be the SJAR. That's a post-trial and appellate right. Perhaps the preparation of the record of trial. Perhaps the waiver of appellate review in a death penalty case. Those are rights that are within the RCM that may not be waivable because those are post-trial and appellate rights created there. They're specifically mentioned in the RCM. However, again, clemency and parole, in the sense of the Secretary of the Navy instruction, which is a complete and distinct regulation, an ancillary regulation, they have nothing to do with what may not be waived, Your Honor, is the government's contention.
I think I understand your argument. Let's move to remedy.
Can I ask just one question before?
Sure. Yeah,
if
yeah.
It's complete and distinct, why does it cite back to Article 74?
If it's complete and distinct from the rules for court martial, Article 74, Your Honor?
From the code?
From Article 74, that's the authority to create the system, Your Honor, and the section of the levy then goes forward and creates...
But nonetheless, it's complete and distinct from the code, in your view?
From the RCM.
It takes its authority from the code, but otherwise... Oh, I see. So you're just arguing RCM here. But you concede that it is integrated with the code.
It derives from the code, yes, Your Honor. The system derives from the code, but again, the Secretary has gone forward and has created the right to petition for clemency and review and has restricted it in certain circumstances. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. Well, I understand that argument if we were dealing with a Title 10 provision outside the code, if parole was wholly created there, then the argument would be this isn't a post-trial proceeding. It's something else that Congress has created to deal with the with people once they've gone through the military justice system. Article 74 appears to be, on its face, part of the military justice system, part of the process of the command structure reviewing what will happen to an individual post-trial. What would we look to say that this is not post-trial? That is there anything in the legislation, the legislative history, the drafting of the rules that would tell us that this is not post-trial? I understand your argument that complete may not be complete, just like we have substantial compliance in certain areas, which means that certain defects are not considered prejudicial. But here we have a procedure which takes place after trial within the Uniform Code of Military Justice. What would we look to say this is not post-trial?
Well, Your Honor, I'm sorry, at risk of repeating myself.
Sure.
Again, the government contends we look at the rules for court-martial themselves, because within the entire rules for court-martial, clemency and parole, those rights created by the Secretary of Navy Instruction, never appear. And again, Article 74 only states that officials may remit or suspend any part or amount of the unexecuted part of any sentence, which is true. Nothing is changed by the fact that adheres to appellant's case as well. Appellant has not waived the right to accept clemency or parole. The government stresses that. Appellant has waived only the right to petition for it. He has also, I believe, from the pretrial agreement, waived the right to mandatory clemency review under the Secretary of the Navy Instruction. But again, there are exceptions within the Secretary of the Navy Instruction that say that in significant circumstances, any official may grant clemency or parole, and then may make exceptions to any of the procedural requirements of the Secretary of the Navy Instruction. Moreover, again, the Schick case, the United States Supreme Court case, it stressed that the President of the United States also has plenary clemency power. So those are unaffected by the fact that appellant has waived the right to request clemency or parole per the Secretary of the Navy Instruction, which is exactly what's stated in the pretrial agreement.
It's the government's position, then, that a convening authority can tell the Secretary of the Navy that I'm going to enter an agreement with an individual to preclude that individual for asking you for relief.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is for public policy reasons, that it is in the government's best interest for the expedition of the military justice system that appellant be able to bargain away rights, not necessarily rights under the RCM, to bargain away rights.
Bargain away rights under the UCMJ.
Bargain away rights under the Secretary of the Navy Instruction, Your Honor, which is what he's done here. In fact, going back to the question about Article 74, perhaps it is, without conceding, perhaps it is possible an appellant still could petition under Article 74. The government's not going to tie itself to that position, but possible, it is possible. But nonetheless, appellant has waived his right to petition under the Secretary of the Navy Instruction. There's nothing illegal about that, Your Honor. The case law backs that up. The Gansmer case, again, the post-trial administrative board, it's an ancillary right created by an ancillary regulation. Appellant, the Court of Military Appeals found that it was okay to do that because the quote from the case, I believe, is the service member is not giving up any rights which he may not relinquish anyway. And that's the case in this case. In the Secretary of the Navy Instruction, it says that he may waive those rights under the second advanced, forgive the Marine Corps.
But again, my understanding of what was at issue in Gansmer were rights wholly outside the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That is an administrative proceeding over which
no military justice official would have any jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor, and perhaps that's the case, but nonetheless, appellant was able to bargain away those because he received a benefit from it. And the court stressed that the decision was not blindly made, and that's certainly the case in this case. There was a lengthy discussion on the record in this case. I believe it's on page 81, where appellant and the military judge discuss the fact that perhaps he could be transferred to a federal system, and you know, perhaps there's a problem with being in a federal system, whether he could actually bargain away the clemency and parole in the federal system. Nonetheless, appellant said, I've been advised by my counsel. I agree with what I'm waiving right here, the right to request clemency and parole under the Secretary of Navy instruction, and I have no problem with waiving that. In paragraph 11H, I believe, of the pretrial agreement, appellant stated that he originated the provisions. There's no question that he was the originator of these provisions per the pretrial agreement. And that is one of the tests in some of these cases that have come before the Court of Appeals.
Voluntariness and initiation is not an issue in this case, is it?
Appellant appears to concede that point, Your Honor, yes.
Judge Irma, I apologize for...
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. Just to get back to my question on remedy. In your brief, you know, your position was we should affirm the CCA. If we were to agree with the appellant's view here, what do we do? Do we just not enforce that provision, or do we throw the whole thing out and send it back?
Yes, Your Honor. The lower court... The bottom line is omit that provision, strike that provision. The lower court in Tate said that if both parties agree that a provision should be stricken, then that's acceptable, and the government would agree that provision may be stricken as a solution. That's the preferred solution, Your Honor.
So the preferred solution would be just to strike that provision and move on. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Which the practical result of the appellant would be, with the pretrial agreement, he's got a 50-year cap. He can petition for clemency in 20 years. By a cursory pre-argument analysis, I believe that clemency, if you got rid of the clemency and parole provision, he would be available to clemency in 9 months from his confinement and subsequent 10 years after confinement began, and then annually after that, if I've calculated correctly per the Secretary of the Navy instruction. Again,
well, in other words, the normal rule would apply to him as far as clemency and parole.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
If we didn't strike the provision but instead struck the entire pretrial agreement, then what would he face on retrial?
He would face life without possibility of parole, Your Honor. And if he had no, if he received the mandatory minimum, then he would not receive good time credit, which he is receiving right now. So again, what he's asking for right now is he's asking basically for that extra, if I calculated correctly, 10 years so he can petition for clemency and parole.
But in the government's position in this case, the government's not asking us to do that then, to
no,
strike the whole agreement.
No, Your Honor, we're not.
Is that a case-specific position, or is that the position of the government as to what we should do as a general matter with respect to these cases? I know you're not conceding the underlying issue, but assuming that if it were our conclusion that this provision should be stricken, is it the government's position that in this case the government is willing to have that provision stricken and the rest of the agreement enforced, or is it the government's position in all such cases, should we receive another one, the remedy should be to strike the provision rather than strike the agreement?
Just in this case, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And what was the case you referred to where if both parties agree, only the provision would be struck?
The lower court in Tate cited another Navy Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals case for that proposition that both parties agreed, despite the fact that there's not a severance provision, which in this case there is not, the agreement could be upheld. In the lower court here, again, the provision that was stricken, as in Thomas, was a provision which usurped, the court found had usurped the Secretary of the Navy's authority to conduct a clemency and parole review. And again, the government would argue that that's exactly what is maintained in this case, because the lower court proactively struck that provision, which was not brought up as an assignment of error by appellant. And because that remains, appellant still may accept clemency and parole, sua sponte granted by the Secretary of the Navy, Navy Clemency and Parole Board, or the President, Your Honor.
How often is clemency and parole offered sua sponte?
Government would only hazard a guess that it's not very frequent, Your Honor. The lessons that the government takes from the case law, the Edwards specifically, the two cases which the government finds controlling here, the Edwards and the Gansmer case, are two. One is that complete doesn't mean complete.
It means in the ambit of the RCM or the substantive due process rights that are listed in Section 705C. This court should look to the rules for court martial itself for those rights. There are two chapters that are specifically titled as the section in 705C refers to, post-trial and appellate rights. Sentencing proceedings also in the RCM. It's something that can be found easily in the RCM. And second, if those rights arise outside of the RCM, which in this case they do, clemency and parole have distinct meanings per the definitions of the second evidence, per the definitions of the RCM itself. If those rights arise outside the RCM, then determine whether the rules for court martial itself specifically prohibits, again, by the due process, the list of due process rights, the right to speedy trial, the right to counsel, and determine if the RCM prohibits. And then admin boards, again, the government concedes that there's a concern with the admin boards, that there's a differentiation at least between the admin boards in this case. But the government will argue that it is an ancillary right created by an ancillary regulation, and it is not doesn't cause the disrepute of the military justice system to waive this right, as in the Gansmer case. And therefore, the two are similar. To generalize, the rights of ancillary regulations, again from the Gansmer case, are waivable. An analysis of public policy completes the government's analysis. The Gansmer case said that the waiver was an important bargaining chip, and taking that away would be denying an accused the right to bargain for his or for her freedom. And that is exactly what's occurred in this case. An appellant who committed murder, who murdered his wife, and received life without possibility of parole, had no chance of parole and had no chance of good conduct time. In this case, received a 50-year sentence and a possibility of parole after 20 years, and a possibility to accept clemency and parole at any point, even though he didn't know that when he struck the pretrial agreement. He thought he'd never get clemency or parole. Now he's got the possibility, albeit small. The efficiency of the system means plea bargains should be encouraged. That's the Santabello Supreme Court case. Mezzanotto, the Supreme Court, waivability of rights is presumed. The most basic rights of criminal defendants are subject to waiver. An appellant may knowingly and voluntarily waive the most fundamental protections afforded by the Constitution. To put in perspective, appellant again is waiving an administrative right, and he can waive double jeopardy, compulsory self-incrimination, jury trial, the right to confront accusers. Absent some affirmative indication of Congress's intent to preclude waiver, statutory provisions are subject to voluntary waiver. That's Mezzanotto. General Eisenhower's discussion was in the context of a hearing which was envisioning transferring the power away from the committing authorities to judge advocates and to trial counsel instead of leaving it with the committing authority. That's completely inapposite to this case, Your Honor. Here, the military judge carefully again reviewed the provisions of the pretrial agreement. Appellant concedes that they were known and voluntary. He escaped a sentence of life without possibility of parole. He admitted the originating the provisions. The pretrial agreement states explicitly that those provisions were waived with an eye towards avoiding life without possibility of parole. In conclusion, Your Honor, appellant's reading of the United States versus Josephic case, the Seventh Circuit decision where he quotes the trial by 12 orangutans, is both humorous, but it's also the reason why appellant's argument must fail. Appellant contends that the government would permit any pretrial agreement short of trial by 12 orangutans. However, Josephic states in full, quote, that if the parties stipulated to trial by 12 orangutans, the defendant's conviction would be invalid, notwithstanding his consent, because of some minimum of civilized procedure is required. And that's the gravamen of Josephic here, and of the RCM, and of the military case law. There's a stronghold of significant rights that must be protected. The due process rights and the rights that were listed, the two final rights, the complete sentencing proceeding and the appellate and post-trial rights. Waiving those would do irreparable damage to the military justice system. However, in contrast, this case involves waiving an administrative right, perhaps within the ambit of the military justice system, but an administrative right unrelated to the rules for court-martial and from a wholly distinct statute. This deal replaces with appellant's full understanding of life without possibility of parole, with 50 years and the possibility of parole within 20. The danger of skirting Josephic's minimum of civilized procedure is just not on the radar in this case. Your Honor, Ronald Reagan has indeed said much about limiting the reach of the government. He also said that the government exists to protect us from each other, but where the government oversteps its boundaries in trying to protect us from ourselves. This is not an appropriate case to do so, Your Honors. Thus, the government respectfully requests that this court uphold the pretrial agreement provision.
Did the Court of Criminal Appeals rule correctly in Thomas?
Yes, Your Honor.
That the provision not accepting was unenforceable?
The government doesn't dispute that holding. It's a similar situation to this. It's exactly the same thing that happened in Tate. They found that it was not allowable to waive the Secretary of the Navy's and the President's authority to grant it, which, if there was some efficiency reason for the President or for the Secretary of the Navy to grant clemency or parole, for instance, to get him out of the prisons, if he was serving for a relatively minor crime but got a too lengthy sentence, perhaps the President would want to grant clemency or parole, and he had waived his pretrial agreement. There may be some efficiency reason that parole or clemency should be granted. Appellant has no right to waive the Secretary of the Navy's power.
But the government doesn't contest the jurisdiction of the court below to enforce Article 74 with respect to striking a provision of the pretrial agreement, then?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you for your argument. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
The power to grant parole dates back to March 4th, 1915, in an act of Congress, 38 U.S.C. statute 1075. And that was the first time that this parole right was created. At the end of World War II, Secretary of War Patterson created for the first time a War Department Clemency Board headed by retired Supreme Court Justice Owen J. Roberts. So important was this, these rights of clemency and parole. 2 years later, they're put into Article 51 of the then Articles of War, and then a year following that, following the Elston Act, they are placed into Article 74 of the UCMJ. The legislative history of 10 U.S.C. 952 and 953, which is also cited in the Second Amendment instruction, makes clear that those statutes are created to provide uniformity for a clemency right that already exists. And there's a uniformity for a clemency right that has existed for some time at that point. And with respect to the Military Correctional Facilities Act of 1968. And so the Secretary of the Navy's instruction does not stand independent of these statutory authorities. It stands on the shoulders of these statutory authorities and implements these rights. It fleshes out these important statutory rights. Now, the government's argument that this pretrial agreement does not eliminate those statutory rights, that it just prevents the effective exercise of those rights, should get the government nowhere in this case. Because in 1984, the President, in the Manual for Courts Martial, anticipated that very argument. And so in RCM 705, it says you may not waive post-trial rights or the exercise of these important post-trial rights, and that's effectively what has been done here. The government is willing to concede the likelihood or the infinitesimal likelihood that the Secretary of the Navy may be in Leavenworth, Kansas, and may decide to grant clemency sua sponte. But everyone here knows that that is not how this process works. How it works is these clemency petitions, the parole petitions, are brought to the Naval Clemency Parole Board, and that's how you get clemency and parole. That's how you avail yourself of the rights that Congress intended that you have, and that's what appellant wishes to do in this case. Now, the government's argument that RCM 705 means that some post-trial rights can be waived and some other post-trial rights cannot be waived has no basis in a plain reading of RCM 705, and it is also not supported by the legislative history. There are two important rights that Congress intended to check the abuses that Congress had seen in World War II. Those two rights, those checks on the convening authority's power, were the right to appeal to the service court and ultimately to this court, and then also to petition the service secretary for clemency and parole. This court should not allow my client or the commanding general in this case to override the congressional intent in passing this specific provision of the article of the UCMJ. If there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
We thank counsel for both parties for your argument in this case. The case is now submitted, and we will take a recess until 5 minutes before 10 o'clock. Our next case is United States against Foster. Counsel for the appellant.
Chief Judge Efron, Judge Baker, Judge Erdman, it's a pleasure to see you all. It's been a long time since I argued before three judges at this court. Good to be back. Your Honors, this was a very factually close case, in which the military judge's actions, both in his abrasive treatment of the defense experts and in his refusal to allow a defense expert to answer legitimate questions, cast him in the role of a partisan advocate and called the legality and the fairness of this trial into question. Your Honors, what I plan on doing today, just to sort of give the court a roadmap, is to try and break my argument up into three areas. The first of those areas will discuss the military judge's overall treatment of the defense expert. It will deal with his failure to allow her to answer legitimate questions posed to her by the panel. I will also discuss the judge's treatment of the experts during his instructions to the panel members. And finally, I will discuss how these actions prejudiced the appellant in this case. From the opening bell of this trial, as the Quintanilla case discusses, I use that magical language, the opening bell of this trial was the military judge's refusal to call an expert an expert. Instead, as we saw later on in the trial, he referred to these judges, or excuse me, to these witnesses in two different ways, two very different and very factually and legally distinctly important ways. He referred to the defense experts as generalized educational testimony, whereas he referred to the government experts as specialized testimony. And as I will discuss later on in my argument, the term general educational testimony simply does not exist under the law. It's important first to address how it is that the military judge treated the government's expert in this case. Contrary to the assertions of the government counsel in their brief, the military judge essentially allowed the government expert in this case free rein, all the way up to saying that in her opinion, she believed the alleged victim in this case, never actually testifying as a human lie detector that she was telling the truth, but saying she putting her imprimatur of approval upon the government expert, saying that she believed the government expert. She allowed the government expert to testify that the child's behavior was consistent with child sex abuse, things that we see routinely in child sex abuse cases. However, to the contrary, the military judge in this case essentially took the heart out of the testimony of both Dr. Huffman and Dr. Talmadge. Indeed, the military judge's antagonism towards Dr. Huffman is extremely apparent throughout this record of trial. Dr. Huffman, as noted by her CV and by our brief in this case, is one of the preeminent experts in this field, who, contrary to what the military judge said, had not been involved in 4 to 5 cases. And you'll recall at one point when he is dressing down the expert, he says she's only been involved in 4 to 5 cases, and she wants to get up here as this Cornell-educated bubba, I think were his exact words. In reality, this expert had been involved in hundreds of cases. What she said is that she'd only testified in 4 to 5 cases, and indeed is one of the preeminent experts in her field. And she herself said, "I simply feel like I am being cross-examined." Well, there's a reason for that. She was indeed being cross-examined.
Counsel, my recollection is that those particular comments were made outside the hearing of the members.
That is absolutely correct.
And so do they have any import for this case, other than as part of your argument with respect to a pattern?
I think that the input that they have is that they show the antagonism of the military judge towards the soft science expert in this case from the beginning, from the opening bell. And then the military judge, along those same lines, the military judge makes a very telling comment, as he says, she's trying to paint the picture that the Navy somehow screwed this case up. Well, indeed, Your Honors, that was the defense case. The defense case was that the investigators in this case screwed the case up, that they failed to follow nationally established protocols for the interviewing of alleged victims in a child sex abuse case. They failed to videotape the first interview with the child. They failed to conduct a forensic interview with the child. They failed to memorialize those interviews that they did conduct. And that, according to at least the first person who asked her questions, the first person in a position of authority, Officer Stegman, he asked leading questions of her. That is what the expert was attempting to do, is to show that the Navy and the local police screwed this one up. That was the defense case. Now, Your Honor, you asked me
for a few minutes ago, that those first questions were during a 39A. Absolutely true. The next questions, however, were not. And before the members, both in his direct questioning of the expert and in his instructions to the members later on, he simply cut the heart out of the defense case. In response to a very valid member question regarding suggestibility of children, it was obvious from the members' questions that they had grave concerns about this area of expertise, not general testimony, but this area of expertise that Dr. Huffman was testifying about, as to the suggestibility of the alleged victim in this case, Kayla. And the military judge asked, in short notice, makes the following statement. You glossed over in your testimony. You don't know what was contained in the police report. You chose to ignore the evidence in this case. You assumed there would be errors in this case. You don't even have an opinion about this case, whereas she tried to, and I'll explain that later. And finally, you have no basis at all to state whether there were any errors in this case, do you? And the expert continually tried to get her point across, that that's what I'm trying to show you. And the expert continually tried to show what the source misattribution errors were in this case, and the military judge simply cut off her answers. This was in front of the members. And combined with the judge's instruction in this case, impermissibly tainted the results of this trial. He was clearly out to discredit the expert. And I think it's important to note a couple of things here, Your Honors. First off, if you follow the trial counsel's redirect immediately after the 39A that Chief Judge Efron just spoke of, you follow the trial counsel's redirect, he basically just picks up where the military judge left off. The military judge did the trial counsel's work for him. But the other important thing is you have to contrast that treatment with the treatment of the defense of the government experts, which I'll get to in a minute. Now, as I said, in this first part, there's sort of two parts to it. The second question is the military judge's instructions. Well, I would argue that the military judge's instructions in this case constitute plain error for several reasons. First off, the military judge continually referred to the defense experts as generalized educational information. He simply refused to put the imprimatur of an expert on their testimony. Now, the government counsel points out, well, but he did the same thing to the government experts. He didn't. He referred to the government experts as specialized testimony, certainly giving an air of expertise or an air of some form of scientific validity to their statements, to that witness's testimony. To the contrary, the military judge refers to Dr. Talmadge and Dr. Huffman as generalized educational information. There is simply no such animal. And you might say, well, the panel members may not know the difference. The panel members may not know what the difference is between an expert witness and a generalized educational witness. And I would argue that that's simply not true, and it's pointed out in this case.
How do we know that at the trial itself, the defense might not have viewed these descriptions as possibly helpful or at least neutral from the defense perspective? That is, I understand the argument that not using the word expert was error, that they're experts, they should be called experts. But in the absence of objection, if we're in a plain error analysis, how do we know that the defense was particularly troubled by this, by these terms in the context of the trial? I understand the argument you're making now, but from a plain error perspective.
I think you have to look at a couple of different things, Your Honor. First off, look at the fact that Dr. Talmadge and Dr. Height both testified that they had been accepted as experts in prior field, in prior court martials. So obviously, getting to your question, obviously the panel members knew that there was something called an expert witness out there. The defense counsel was simply, this was somewhat of a unique and remarkable, in my opinion, reading of the record in this case, that the defense counsel was simply never even offered the opportunity to opine on this matter. The military judge simply said, this is what I'm going to do, period. Trial counsel had some generalized concerns about it, and military judge said, hey, you know, this is what I'm going to do. It would have been almost futile for a defense counsel that had been bludgeoned previously by this military judge to stand up and do anything. But to answer your question directly,
well, that's where my question is. what establishes in this record that we had a level of hostility here where the defense counsel would have been reduced to simply accepting an impossible situation?
Go ahead, Judge.
Do we have a case here in which the defense counsel simply stopped objecting during the trial?
Absolutely. And I think that that is shown because of the colloquy between the military judge and the defense counsel as it relates to Dr. Huffman, in which the defense continually tried to get out. And, you know, you have to, looking at the realities of trial work, I'm, you know, looking at two lieutenants who were doing that, you know, certainly didn't raise the issue of ineffective assistance. That's not what we're here arguing. They're doing their best against a senior, experienced military judge. And the defense counsel is saying, but, Your Honor, no, this is what I'm going to do. If you look at that colloquy as it relates to Dr. Huffman, this military judge made it clear very early that he was not suffering the objections of defense counsel. And I think you're absolutely right. That's what happened in this case.
At what point would we look at the record and say, This is a situation in which the defense could not even put its objections on the record?
I think you need to look no further than the colloquy with which the defense tried to raise their concerns about the overly harsh treatment of Dr. Huffman. And I think it's in the 980s somewhere, Judge, but I've never been very good about quoting exact pages of the record. But to get right back to your original question.
But there we've got the defense saying, here's the problem we have.
Yes.
And so why wouldn't the defense have had the ability in the context of this trial to say the same thing with respect to the designation of the experts using the alternative terms, saying, Your Honor, we'd like you to clarify that instruction?
Because I think, as your judge intimated, Your Honor intimated a second ago, it's the defense gave up in this case, and he just saw the government.
I wasn't intimating that. I was asking for a demonstration that that was in fact the record.
And I think that that's what happened. I think that you can see that both from the colloquy as it relates to Dr. Huffman, and as you go further along, the colloquy with the trial counsel, in which the trial counsel raised some concerns about the using of that language. The military judge berated him. There was no sense in it. And so to get back to your original question, Your Honor, what makes you think that this just wasn't a conscious choice by the defense counsel? No defense counsel would make that conscious choice. There's not a defense counsel I know of who would say, well, I'm going to allow the military judge to call the government expert this lofty term of specialized testimony and yet allow them to refer to my expert with this lowly term of generalized educational testimony. But it's also important, Your Honor, to relate that back to what happened earlier in the trial, which is by the time that the military judge got done gutting Dr. Huffman's testimony, there wasn't much left. And so the defense is left with what the military judge created. And later on, the military judge essentially berates the defense for not having put on or not having applied the facts of this case to the experts, and yet he's the one who created that animal. He said that they couldn't do it, and then in his instructions, he emphasizes over and over and over again the fact that the witness did not testify as to certain things. And that leads me to the portion of the argument, Your Honors, where the military judge improperly limited the questioning of Dr. Huffman. Your Honors have reviewed hundreds of records of trial in these cases, in child sexual abuse cases, and these types of experts routinely testify about the same thing. That is, I have reviewed the data in this case, the data being the interviews or lack of interviews, the lack of recordation of the interviews, the fact that there were leading questions used, the lack of a videotape, etc. Based on those interviews, Dr. Huffman, and your expertise, do you have an opinion about the reliability of the data in this case? I do. That data is unreliable. These are questions that are routinely asked in child sexual abuse cases throughout the system. That is what the military judge was trying to do. She was trying to explain to the panel members that she reviewed the fact that there was no videotape, and the fact that the alleged victims were interviewed several times, and the fact that some of those interviews consisted of leading questions, and based on her review and her expertise, she had grave concerns regarding the validity of the data. The trial counsel can always cross-examine the witness, but the questions that Dr. Huffman attempted to ask and to answer were on their face facially valid questions. And it is up to the trial counsel, not the military judge, to cross-examine her. The military judge, if he had concerns with the questions that Dr. Huffman was attempting to ask or answer, had several options. Do what he did with Dr. Height. Ask the questions and then say, give an instruction to the members that say no witness is allowed to get up and testify that somebody is or is not telling the truth.
the typical human lie detector testimony that we see in these cases all the time. In many ways, it's not much different than, say, a blood splatter expert who says, based on my review of the blood splatter, the defendant's testimony about self-defense is consistent or inconsistent with that. The military judge will get up and give an instruction and say, he can't tell you that the witness is or is not telling the truth. He can only tell you that in his review of the data, that data is or is not consistent with a particular version of events. That's all the expert was trying to do in this case. Again, if the military judge had concerns, you ask a question, you give an instruction, you allow the trial counsel to cross-examine. You can rephrase the question to some degree.
It appears that one of the difficulties here is when the witness was telling the judge they need to know it's impossible for them to tell the truth. Those words suggest that there was no basis for a trial. What's the judge supposed to do in that situation when the witness says, I'm going to testify, it's impossible for the members to tell whether the testifying witness, that testimony, is the truth?
It's important to note that there was actually, I think, three questions asked during that particular colloquy. The first one was, it's important for them to know that nobody can testify that she is or is not telling the truth. That question, I believe, is clearly permissible. Because that she is or is that nobody can testify that she is or is not telling the truth. That type of a question, we would argue, should have been permitted, and she should have been allowed to answer. The second question was,
that's a question that the judge can deal with right off the bat. That's human lie detector testimony.
That's human lie detector, and the military judge would not allow her to testify to that.
Don't need an expert one way or another on that.
It would have been helpful certainly to have an expert to explain why it is that nobody can say that, because of the lack of the reliability of the data.
Is that the reason why it can't be said, or is the reason why it can't be said is that that testimony isn't allowed in a court-martial? It's not allowed in any trial.
When you say that testimony,
then when a witness gets up and says no one can tell whether a person is telling the truth or not, that's classic lie detector testimony that nobody can testify to. You don't need an expert on that. You need a military judge or a trial judge to tell the members that it's their job to determine whether somebody's telling the truth.
Absolutely.
Or not.
But what I was saying, Your Honor, is that the question or the statement in response to a question that no one can tell you whether or not she is or is not telling the truth is a permissible question or a permissible answer. The next question I believe you asked about was the one that says no one can say that Kayla is or is not telling the truth. I believe is also a permissible question, which is no, you know, and again, you ask, what is the military judge supposed to do? You ask a question and you give an instruction, or you simply rephrase the question. The witness never said that Kayla could not be believed, and that's what the military judge was trying to caution against.
Well, what's the meaning of the phrase, they need to know it's impossible for them to determine if she's telling the truth?
But certainly not saying it's impossible that she is not telling the truth. Those are two different questions.
It's impossible for them to determine that she's telling the truth.
Or not telling the truth. Again, the military judge simply could have rephrased the question instead of just bulldozing through it, as he did with that question and then the next one, which was a perfectly permissible question, which is about the Humpty Dumpty effect, something that is asked in child sex abuse cases routinely, which is, once a case has fallen apart like this, it is extremely difficult to be able to rely on the data that has been created, because you're trying to essentially take a jigsaw puzzle with missing pieces that's been thrown on the ground and say, fix it, and you can't do that. And that is what the witness was attempting to testify to. Now, I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I'm trying to figure out what expertise this particular witness was going to provide to the members that the judge precluded the members from hearing. If it's simply testimony that no one can tell whether someone's telling the truth or not, that's something that the judge can tell the members. There's no expertise being involved there. That's a principle of law. If there is something about the particular questioning that would make it difficult to ascertain the telling of the truth, what specific question was the defense precluded from asking?
Well, The problem with that, Your Honor, is we're not particularly sure because of the way that the military judge simply cut the questioning off, as opposed to allowing the defense counsel an opportunity to question the witness during the 39A session, as he did the government during Dr. Talmadge before he testified before the members, because the military judge simply never offered that opportunity. But I would proffer to the bench that it's really fairly simple. It is as a result of the fact that the data in this case has been impermissibly tainted, it is, use whatever term you want, extremely difficult to put the genie back in the bottle. The data in this case is, the language that I hear in these cases all the time is, the data in this case is unreliable. The interviews in this case are unreliable. Why? Because of the fact that the process is tainted.
And where in the record does it show that the defense wanted to ask that question and the judge said you can't answer, ask that question?
It does not, Your Honor. And that's where we get to either a plain error analysis and I believe, Your Honor, that it's important to note that that's why the Supreme Court and this court have set up sort of this different standard for the question of whether or not a military judge has become a partisan advocate than they do in simple in other cases. Whereas in a traditional case, you might look at this case and say, well, it's a plain error analysis. And certainly there is some portion of a plain error analysis. But in Quintanilla and in other cases, and the Supreme Court has said, you also have this other standard out there which says, has the reliability and fairness of this court-martial been called into question as a result of the military judge's actions?
Well, is that where we are in this case then, that there has to be a link between the argument on partisan advocacy and the limitations on what was presented, and that is that, as I understand your argument, then the limitations of what was presented were not expressly identified on the record as to what the defense would have asked, and the reason that it wasn't addressed was because of the hostility of the judge.
I think that you have to look at those two standards and realize that the Supreme Court has established this heightened standard, or different standard, I should say, in cases of military judge abusing his discretion. And you have to look at those two standards together, and you have to look at the realities of this case, which are, at some point, the defense counsel, I hate to say this, but gets tired of getting beat up and doesn't want to get up and make perfunctory objections simply to get yelled at again by a military judge who had assumed control of this entire trial, or at least assumed control of the defense case by cutting out the guts of the two expert witnesses. Now, Your Honors, the final prong in all of this, of course, is, so what? Let us assume for a second that the military judge abused his discretion. Let us assume for a second that there is plain error. So what? What is the prejudice to the appellant in this case? And we would argue that the prejudice is clear. This was, by all intents and certainties, you can tell this by the fact that, A, there was a very active court-martial panel, and you can tell this by the fact that the members deliberated for quite a while. You can tell this by the fact that the members had a number of questions that they wanted to ask Dr. Huffman. This was a factually close case. The complaining witnesses' stories were riddled with inconsistencies and contradictions of the exact type that Dr. Huffman warned about can result when these types of investigations are not undertaken properly. And you simply look at Kayla's testimony, where the number of times the abuse allegedly occurred varied. The story that she told to Officer Stegman varied considerably from the story that she told to Dr. Hite. As to where the incidents occurred, as to when she moved, you might say, well, we see this in child sex abuse cases all the time, these types of little differences. But there are some of these that are simply glaring differences, never mind the mother's testimony, who we don't address in our brief, but which is addressed in our supplemental petition. But much more grave things, much more serious.
Well, wait, don't say never mind the mother's testimony. The mother's testimony was that she saw her son and daughter kissing.
Her mother's testimony.
You never mind that?
No, I'm saying
that shouldn't be part of the harmless error analysis.
I understand the judge's, Your Honor's question. What I'm saying, Your Honor, is I wasn't discussing that point, but certainly I would be happy to discuss that with you. The mother's testimony that she saw the
children. I don't need to discuss anything in particular. I think you need to discuss all the evidence that's on the table. that the government might discuss and say, that's why is that nonetheless strong or weak or whatever, rather than just pick particular items in the victim's testimony and say, this is inconsistent with this.
What I'm trying to show, Your Honors, is that this was a factually closed case from the opening bell. The mother's testimony was inherently contradicted by the testimony of Officer Stegman on several salient points. The child's testimony was contradicted by her testimony from one interview to the next. The mother's testimony was contradictory to prior statements that she had given. And so,
in particular, and on what page?
I'll have to look during the government's argument during the next. I don't have only have 15.
This is your chance to do that.
I will do that, Your Honor. And I will show you specific pages in which the mother's testimony that we point out was inherently contradicted. And therefore, the prejudice in this case is nearly overwhelming. And the fact that this was a factually closed case and a case in which could have gone and would have gone, we believe, to the defense had the expert witnesses been allowed to testify as they wish to do so. And, Your Honor, I will point out those specific provisions of the record during my rebuttal time.
And particularly after you hear what the government said.
Yes, sir. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Major Kevin Harris, and I represent the United States in this case. The question before the court today is not whether this was a close case or not. It's whether, from the view of a reasonable person observing the proceedings, whether the court martial's legality, fairness, and impartiality were put in doubt by the military judge's actions and questions when taken as a whole in the context of the trial, not extracts viewed in a vacuum. In applying this objective test, the government would respectfully submit that the appropriate conclusion is that the military judge did not abuse his discretion and the appellant in this case received the fair trial of which he was entitled. The appellant asserts that somehow the military judge kept the expert witnesses, the defense expert witnesses, from presenting a case with which they intended to. But the government would bring court's attention, invite the court's attention, to at least four areas in the record of trial that speak otherwise. First, Appellate Exhibit 17, the defense's pretrial motion to compel the production of witnesses to include Drs. Talmadge and Dr. Huffman. And in pages specifically relating to Dr. Huffman, for instance, pages 6 to 8, it makes it clear that the defense intended Dr. Huffman to testify about the effects of multiple interviews on the child, and I'm reading, quoting from here, Your Honor, the effect of multiple interviews on the child, the effect of leading questions, the effect of improper interview techniques, and what can make the child actually believe something is true that it is not. Again, record of 216 in a pretrial motion session, where they're at that point litigating whether Dr. Talmadge is going to be produced, but Dr. Huffman, the discussion of Dr. Huffman is intertwined in there. At 216, the defense, while conceding the inappropriateness of human lie detector evidence, specifically states, and I will quote again, they do not intend those witnesses to get into the specifics of this case. Again, that is why these two witnesses are generalized educational experts. Record at 859. At 8:59, the military judge...
Hang on, generalized educational... What do you call them again?
I just refer to them as generalized expert...
What did the judge refer to them as?
I'm sorry, sir, I don't have that right in front of me, Your Honor.
The appellant said we have the educational and specialized testimony, and then we have educational testimony. Are those terms of art? Is that educational testimony?
No, Your Honor, they're not terms of art. I was merely attempting to mirror what it was that the military judge's instructions portrayed, which was an accurate reflection of the record here. You had Dr. Talmadge and Dr. Huffman, defense experts, who spoke in generalities. Opposed to that, you had Dr. Heitz Clausus, and I apologize, I'm probably not pronouncing your name correctly, who had actually diagnosed the specific witnesses in this case. And she gave specialized testimony relating to a diagnosis of the two children involved, the victim and her brother. So again, just returning very briefly back, there are two other sections in the record where, again, the defense makes clear at trial that Dr. Huffman was going to testify in, to use the term, in generalities. Record of 859 and record of 802. In both those sections, there's a colloquy going on between defense counsel and the military judge. And for instance, at 859, Well, the military judge, in conclusion, states, as he understands it, she, meaning Dr. Huffman, is simply educating the members by citing studies that she has done with Dr. Cece and others have done as to the effect of suggestibility on the accuracy of reporting. And defense counsel's answers? I agree. And that was our intention of our testimony, Record 859. Again, so here we have the record showing that at trial, the military judge absolutely did not curtail the defense's ability to present a case. What the military judge did do was put proper limitations on a witness who was before him. In applying this objective test to the military judge's actions and his questions, it is not an easy test at times for the court to perform because all the court has before it is the cold record. That record does not disclose demeanor, facial expressions, voice tone, inflection, pace, or the volume of participants. But the court does have a number of things at its disposal. First, it has a legal presumption. Military judges are presumed to be fair and impartial, and that is the bar which the appellant fails to overcome. Second,
if they're presumed to be impartial, what about the 39A? I understand it's in the 39A, but is that the language of impartiality?
No, Your Honor, the government would readily concede that there are actions, in this case, by the military judge, the tone, the nature of his questions, and that language, particularly the Cornell Baba language that the court cites to, that does properly call into question a military judge's actions. But again, this is not an area of absolutes, Your Honor. It's a spectrum, if you will. On one end of the spectrum, we have absolute impartiality.
I guess my real question is, if a judge is presumed to be impartial, is that presumption lost if you have a judge saying things like that?
No, Your Honor. It's not enough to overcome the presumption. In addition to the, and one of the indicators of that, Your Honor, is I guess would best be referred to as circumstantial evidence. In this case, a lack of any objections. Nowhere in the record of trial will the court find a single objection by defense counsel to any of the questions asked by the military judge. What the court will find is a statement by the defense counsel that they were, per se, nothing inappropriate by those questions. Now, appellant may allude to the fact that at some point the defense counsel did request an instruction regarding the military judge's demeanor. Specifically at page 917, the defense counsel asked for the instructions, stating that they had a general concern about Dr. Huffman's testimony and the military judge's questioning of it. Immediately, we bring the court's attention to the immediate response by the military judge there. The military judge responds back after being labeled as being combative. He denies it and says he was not combative. He didn't think that he was being combative with the witness. And again, here, despite the assertions of the appellant to the contrary, whether it's a Navy Lieutenant JG, a captain in the Marine Corps, that defense counsel has a moral, ethical, and legal obligation to zealously advocate for their client. If truly the defense counsel had felt that the military judge's demeanor was problematic, they had an obligation to get it on the record. And instead, what do we have? We have the reply from the defense counsel when the military judge says he was not being combative. Sure. And then we move on from there. And contrary to what the appellant has just asserted, after 9/17, the next time this issue comes up, it's not because the defense counsel is being beaten down that it doesn't come up again. It comes up again because the military judge himself brings it up. The section on 9/17 happens at the end of the defense's case on a Friday afternoon. They're going to roll into rebuttal evidence on Monday morning, and on Monday morning, when the prosecution tells the military judge they're not going to have a rebuttal case, the military judge, sua sponte, goes back to this area, and I'm citing specifically not to 944 in the record, and the military judge makes it clear he wants this fleshed out. Those are his words. He wants this fleshed out on the record. From 944 to 949 in the record, the military judge painstakingly, calmly, and in a very reflective manner explains his interactions, as he saw it, between himself and Dr. Huffman. The defense counsel has the opportunity to look at the military judge's instruction, which has been crafted, which incidentally appears to be almost verbatim from the military judge's bench book. And again, the defense counsel has no objection to that instruction. The standard instruction is sufficient to overcome what now the appellant casts as this the military judge's combative demeanor that kowtowed the defense and prohibited the appellant from getting a fair trial. Likewise, the government would point out nowhere in the record of trial will the court find a motion for recusal from the military judge. Nowhere will the court find a motion for a mistrial due to the questions asked by the military judge. And specifically, would invite the court's attention to Appellate Exhibit 52. Appellate Exhibit 52 is a member's question. A number of military judges' questions, which the appellant takes issue with, were directly coming from Appellate Exhibit 52. I believe it's Commander Lieutenant Colonel Ford's question. He asked the expert witness, or wanted to ask the expert witness, have you ever interviewed Carol Foster? Have you read reports of the interviews? Those are two of the four questions listed on Appellate Exhibit 52. And the military judge, as he explains in great detail between 944 and 948, took those two questions, asked the expert, Dr. Hoffman, those questions, and then asked logical follow-on questions. And again, now the government would concede at times his questions do take on a leading tone. But contrary to what the appellant asserts, it doesn't quite get to the same point as normal cross-examination does. We'd invite the court's attention to the record at 832 to 842. That's where the trial counsel cross-examined the expert, Dr. Hoffman. And we'd invite the court to compare the leading cross-examination of trial counsel at 832 to 842 with the questions that the military judge asked. And regarding cross-examination, again, the test is taking the military judge's actions review in the context of the entire trial, not a mere snippet or extract. We just, for a moment, like to dwell on this statement by the witness that I feel like I'm undergoing cross-examination, and that's not verbatim her statement. It comes on page 860 of the record. We'd invite the court's attention to the six lines that preceded it to put it in a context. As we get into page 859 of the record, we're in an Article 39A session. Members are absent, witnesses present on the stand. There's a discussion going on between defense counsel and the military judge. The best way to characterize it would probably be that the defense counsel is looking for some guidance from the military judge on what areas he can get into and what areas he should veer away from as they continue back in their examination once they bring the members back in. In the middle of this dialogue between defense counsel and the military judge, and again, this is the bottom half of 859, the witness spontaneously interrupts the military judge. The military judge is about to finish the sentence, I mean that, and then the witness cuts the military judge off. I tried to get into the record, though, that a good forensic interviewer would have at least audiotaped or videotaped it. The military judge responds, they did, they tried. Again, he's cut off. Well, that's forensic, and again, we have this cut-off continuation. Military judge, we had a failure of the videotape. It was done. Witness replies, well, it was attempted, but she should have double-checked her equipment and made sure it was working. And again, military judge, well, I'm sure, you know, I don't think there's any, and then he's cut off by the witness. I don't feel like you're letting me say, you're not even letting me, I feel like I'm under, you know, cross-examination. So again, if we look at that line in a vacuum, it casts one light on the military judge. What the government would ask is that this court, in applying its test, do so in a proper manner, as it will, put it in context.
With respect to the instructions given by the judge and not asking the government to concede one way or another on the result, if we were to conclude in this case that we should say something about that instruction, is it the government's wish that we should encourage military judges to use their creativity in describing what experts are and avoid the term expert, or should we encourage the judges to use the words that are in the rule before they start exercising their creativity as to how to describe particular testimony?
Probably to err towards the side of taking, not being creative. But again, regarding the instructions, First, they would be viewed under a plain error analysis, as again, there was no objection to the military judge's instructions. And again, putting it in the context of the issue before the court today, the military judge, we invite the court's attention to the discussions with the military judge, the defense counsel, and the trial counsel on the record as they go into determining what those instructions are going to be. And again, contrary to what's been asserted to the court today, the defense counsel and the trial counsel were given absolute free rein to give the military judge input. In fact, there's another portion of the record trial would invite the court's attention to, just to counter again this assertion that somehow the military judge was kowtowing the defense counsel. In the record of 592 to 599, we have the testimony of Dr. Heitz-Kositz. Again, I apologize for my pronunciation of her name. And the trial counsel offers Prosecution Exhibit 10. The defense counsel makes objections to Prosecution Exhibit 10, that it's cumulative, that it contains hearsay, and his exact words, and that it's also unfair, which, again, this military judge recast that in probably the proper light under the 403, under a proper objection under 403. But regardless, we invite the court's attention to the record at 592, where the military judge himself, sua sponte, takes issue with portions of Prosecution Exhibit 10, the government's expert testimony, the government's expert documentation. And it is the military judge who suggests that they look at that closer. And then defense counsel comes back in after a brief recess, there's a discussion, and portions of it are redacted. Portions that would have got into the lie detector, the human lie detector area, just like the military judge did with the other experts. This court, as it applies its analysis, again, as we stated earlier, it's not an area of absolutes. It's a spectrum. As the court looks at the military judge's actions in the context of the trial, there are some other guideposts the government would offer to the court, and that is this court's precedent. First, United States versus Burton. Burton is a guilty judge alone context, and United States versus Burton would invite the court to compare the questions asked by the military judge in United States versus Burton to the accused during the sentencing phase of that guilty plea. And would invite the court's attention to compare the acerbic nature, the pointed nature, the cross-examination, if you will, of the accused rising on the stand from the military judge. This court ultimately affirms the conviction in Burton. United States versus Acosta. In Acosta, we had the military judge in a contested member's trial asked to witness a series of 89 questions. 89 questions that ultimately lead the witness who's on the stand to disclose previously undisclosed, uncharged misconduct performed by Acosta. Acosta's on trial for buying drugs. This witness, under the military judge's 89 questions, reveals previously undisclosed, uncharged times where Acosta bought drugs from the witness. And in that case, in addition to affirming that, this court also is confronted with a military judge who, in the middle of those 89 questions, has civilian counsel stand up, attempt to interject, request an Article 39A, and as this court phrased it, the military judge curtly, to use the court's adjective, told him, "No, sit down, Mr. Tranberg, you raise an issue of entrapment." Under those facts, this court affirmed. And on the far end of the spectrum, we have the circus-like trial, United States versus Kentonia, 56 MJ 37. Even with those ridiculous facts, where the military judge got into some sort of an altercation with a witness off the stand during trial, but off the stand during a recess, even with those ridiculous facts, this court remanded it for a debate hearing, for further fact-finding. But what the government would bring to the court's attention is even with those ridiculous facts, Senior Judge Sullivan, in his dissenting opinion, would have affirmed the conviction, despite, and to use his words, the fact that the military judge behaved inappropriately. We have nothing like that before the court with this case. The military judge, when his actions are viewed in total, with those guideposts in mind, any reasonable observer would not question the court martial's legality, fairness, and impartiality. If there are no further questions, The government would ask this court, I'm sorry, Your Honor, the government would simply in conclusion ask the court to affirm that which was adjudged, approved, and affirmed below. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Opportunity for defense.
Thank you again, Your Honors. Your Honor, I would like to sort of pick up with the question that Judge Baker left me with a few minutes ago, which is, show me specific portions in the record of trial which demonstrate prejudice in this case. Your Honor, I'd like to point you to several. Record at page 757, the mother testifies that the children's heads, when she allegedly found them kissing, popped up like firecrackers. We're on record at page 460, where later on, Officer Stegman, I think it's 460, I don't have the exact site with me, says, that is not what happened. That is not what she told me. She also said she used other language during that first interview with Officer Stegman that she later denied having used. You'll also note at record page 454 that the mother herself had been sexually abused. On record at page 464, in direct answer to the judge's question, when she talks about this kiss that she discovered, she says originally, or she testifies at trial that she actually saw the kiss, but she had given prior statements as brought out during her cross-examination, where she said that she saw the two of them together. Kayla told them that she had been kissing, and then also says at one point that she saw the two of them together, and James told her that the two of them had been kissing. This is at 464. The record at page 434, the mother testifies that Kayla was topless when she saw them during this alleged kiss. The record at page 511, Kayla says that she was fully clothed. And the record at page 454, the mother's psychological history is discussed in great detail. It is, the mother denies having ever been treated or diagnosed for bipolar disorder, evidence that was later, that was determined during cross-examination to be not true. So these matters, as it relates to the mother in particular, certainly show that her testimony was at least questionable, and a matter that this court has to take into consideration in determining whether or not there was prejudice in this case. As it relates to Kayla's testimony, at page 506, Kayla testifies as to the number of times the incidents allegedly occurred and where they allegedly occurred, and then during her cross-examination, it is determined that the amount of times and the locations of these incidents have changed greatly over the course of the numerous interviews that she has given in this case. At page 507, she talks about this window that was creaking, and that was sort of how she alerted the appellant that somebody was coming and that the abuse had to stop. And yet later on in her cross-examination and in the examination, I believe, of Dr. Height, it is determined that that testimony gradually increased in specificity over time, in direct contradiction to what Dr. Huffman testified would happen generally in cases, and in which Dr. Huffman never got into on the case in chief, but in which it clearly shows that this was a factually closed case. James testifies that he saw everything, whereas previously James had said, or rather Kayla said, that James knocked on the door and was told to go away and never entered into the room, that the door had been closed. So clearly this was a case that could have gone either way. And therefore, we would argue that the prejudice in this case is clear. The number of times the abuse allegedly occurred has changed, the stories have changed, and the locations of the incidents has increased with the number of interviews, which is the exact type of poison that Dr. Huffman warned against. Now, in response to some of the matters brought up by my opposing counsel, he points out that in one very brief portion of the record of trial that the military judge denied an objection or granted an objection by the defense counsel and says, there you go, members of the court, that's proof that the presumption of an impartial judge has not been overcome. Members of the court, you have to look at the entire record of this case. Clearly, if there is a presumption that the military judge is impartial, clearly that presumption has been obliterated in this case, much as it was in Quintanilla.
Well, both counsel both argued they want us to look at the entire record, so you can be confident in that.
Thank you, Your Honor. And then if you look at the military judge's questioning of Dr. Height and compare it to the military judge's questionings of Dr. Huffman, it is nearly apples and oranges. The difference could not be more stark. The military judge put his imprimatur of approval on Dr. Huffman, or on Dr. Height, very early in this case, his stamp of disapproval on Dr. Huffman, and continued with that stamp throughout this trial, culminating in instructions to the panel that were both inaccurate as a matter of law, confusing as a matter of fact, and which cut the heart out of the defense case. And for those reasons, members of the court, the defense respectfully requests that you reverse the findings of the trial court and remand for a new trial in this case. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. That concludes our hearings for this week, and the court will stand in recess.